Our next speaker is Arushin Pillay. Arushin, before coming to the bar, worked for 7 years as a solicitor, mainly for a plaintiff's firm and mainly in personal injuries, occupational health and safety. Since coming to the bar, he's practiced in the personal injuries field and in occupational health and safety. He's represented numerous statutory bodies, including the Nurses Board of Victoria, Victims of Crime Assistance Tribunal, and the Legal Aid Commission. And he regularly appears in VCAT, acting for professional people, coming before their professional disciplinary bodies. He recently completed the National Institute of Trial Advocates Trial Skills Program at the University of North Carolina. Seems to be a good reason to go to the States to me. And he's going to talk to you about how pain is treated in the common law system. He was just telling me the reason he got this gig is because, like me, he rides a bike. And like most bike riders, he's been injured on a bike. So he recently fractured his collarbone getting caught in tram tracks, and Michael Green said, well, you'll know all about pain. Come along and talk to the solicitor. So could I welcome our most recent victim, Arushin Pillay.
I don't have a transport accident claim, so you can all rest assured that I'm not looking for representation. Traditionally, the common law has dealt with injured people seeking compensation for pain and suffering by looking at them subjectively, by taking each plaintiff as they find them and seeking, by the court's own methods, to assess that individual's pain. There has developed a tension over the last few decades between the common law's approach to dealing with pain and government and insurers' desire for greater objectivity and certainty when dealing with individual claimants coming before the courts, either in statutory schemes or generally at common law. In this discussion this morning, what I wish to talk about is firstly the traditional approach that the common law has had to dealing with pain, and then to talk about some of the responses that governments have made in addressing the uncertainty with which the common law has dealt with people suffering and claiming for pain. Now, the latter part of that discussion really focuses on how Victoria has sought to deal with the subjective nature of pain, and that is by introducing gateways or thresholds prior to people coming to court and seeking to say that they're in pain and ought to be compensated. Now that takes us nicely to a dark and stormy night in Adelaide in 1960. In 1960, in Adelaide, begins the High Court's discussion of some of the general principles associated with pain and suffering compensation. Now why Adelaide and why a dark and stormy night? Well, in the paper that I've given you, you'll see reference to a case of Tudor and Humble. Now in that case, a press photographer from one of the Adelaide papers was out on a dark and stormy Adelaide night taking photographs when he was run down by a car. As a result of that running down, he lost his leg and he was partially paralysed. The case went on appeal to the High Court, and ultimately Justice Windeyer began to give a series of judgments which dealt with how the court should deal with pain. Now, in Tudor and Humble, Justice Windeyer said, firstly, the courts must look to the individual. They must look subjectively to their circumstances and must try to assess what the pain and suffering consequences are for that individual person. Not only that, Justice Windeyer said, the person must know that they have suffered the injury. They must know that they are in pain and that they are suffering. But that question about insight, about whether the individual knows that they have suffered pain and suffering, did not arise specifically in this case, but it arose in another case in the 1960s, which I've referred to in the paper, called Skelton and Collins, where the injured person there was rendered unconscious by reason of the tortious act of the defendant. Now, Justice Windeyer and Skelton and Collins said, where the injured person has no knowledge of their pain and suffering, then they ought not be compensated for it, other than by a nominal sum. Now, at that stage in the 1960s, debate raged on that point, but that was the law, and that was the principle espoused by Justice Windeyer and upheld by the court. So those are some of the traditional principles arising from those cases in the 1960s, which still hold good today, assuming you can get to court to try your case for pain and suffering. Just lastly, on some of those principles, it's not necessary for there to be an actual physical injury when the plaintiff comes to court. What is necessary is that there is a physical experience of pain. And you'll see, I've taken an extract from a case which illustrates, I think, quite vividly how pain of itself can lead to a compensation award. Now, the background to this case of Tucker and Hospital Corporation is this, that Mrs. Tucker was pregnant with her third child. She was, let's say, due to have a caesarean on day six. So on day five, she went to the hospital and she was resting in hospital and they served her a meal. She had the meal, which was described as a three-course meal, and after that, she went into spontaneous labour. Now, the specialists were very concerned. One, they knew they needed to perform the caesarean, but she'd eaten. And the anaesthetic advice was, you can't operate on a person who's just eaten. So they couldn't give her a general anaesthetic. Instead, they opted to give her an epidural. But as you might have gathered by reading that quote, the epidural didn't work. And they didn't find out that the epidural didn't work until the surgeon began to make the incision. And when he did, you can read exactly what happened. And you can imagine that the pain that she felt would have been absolutely excruciating. And just to finish off from what happens after that quote, despite them trying to top up the epidural and despite them sending the husband out of the room to top up the epidural top-up still didn't work effectively. And she went through the operation still feeling the effects of the knife. Now, she was always going to have the surgery. She was always going to be cut open. And there was nothing wrong with the cut or the surgical incision. There's nothing wrong with the stitching up. But when she sued, she was able to recover for the pain of that physical experience. So the common law says, yes, you might not come to us with an amputated leg or partial paralysis, but if you've experienced the pain, we will look at you and your individual circumstance and the circumstance of your pain and compensate you for it. In the psychiatric context, though, courts have treated pain slightly more sceptically. And a body of law has developed around psychiatric injury, which is much more restrictive than claims for pain when you have sustained a physical injury alone. And Gifford and Strang Patrick Stevedoring probably shows up exactly how hard the law is if you come before the court saying, I have a psychiatric injury and I'm in pain. Now, Barry Gifford was a wharf worker in Sydney. And in 1990, he was run over and crushed by a forklift. I'm not sure if it's this forklift, but it's very similar. And he died a horrific death. And the family was told, don't look at the photographs because it's so distressing. When he died, he left a family, an estranged wife, Christine, and three teenage children. Now, the family brought an action against the Stevedoring Company. And the Stevedoring Company, while admitting that it was negligent in causing his death, said, firstly, it didn't owe a duty of care to Mr. Gifford's family. And secondly, it said, you haven't suffered a recognisable psychiatric injury. Now, when the case came before the High Court decided for the family on the duty of care point and said, yes, Stevedore and Company should have had in contemplation the family as being closely connected with Mr. Gifford. But it then said, and it enforced a very hard rule in this area of law, it said, if you do not suffer from a recognisable psychiatric injury arising from the tortious conduct, you cannot recover. You cannot recover. And so in that case, it allowed the claims of the three teenage children, all who were held to have suffered not just pain, grief and trauma as a result of the death of their father, but because they also had a psychiatric injury. But the High Court said Mrs. Gifford couldn't recover, even though it said she has suffered enormously, she's grieving, it's terribly traumatic for her, and she's obviously pained by what's happened to her estranged husband. She could not recover because she couldn't prove a recognisable psychiatric injury, so her claim failed. Just an aside there, it's interesting to note that if that had happened in Victoria, Mrs. Gifford would have been able to recover under crimes compensation legislation. Under Section 85B of the Sentencing Act, she would have been able to recover for injury as defined there, which includes such things as grief, trauma and anguish. And when you make a Sentencing Act claim, you recover on normal common law principles. So she would have been able to recover compensation for her pain and suffering, but only via the Sentencing Act, not via the common law. So, broadly speaking, the common law is really saying, if you're an injured person, come to us with your reports of pain and we will try to deal with you on an individual basis, save and except for psychiatric injuries, which are dealt with slightly more stringently by the common law. Now, over the last few decades, Victoria has moved to a position of restricting access to common law damages for pain and suffering. It has done that, not as they've done in New South Wales, but which is by asking courts to find whether a person is injured according to a certain scale and therefore allocated compensation as X percent of the worst case. But Victoria has done it by front-loading the system and in putting in place a series of gateways or thresholds over which injured persons must pass or pass through in order to claim compensation. And it's here that you really see the tension between the common law's position and the desire for greater certainty and objectivity in the assessment of pain and suffering and injury generally. Now, I'm sure all of you know this, but I'll just quickly go over it again. If you're injured under one of the statutory schemes, the Transport Accident Scheme or the Accident Compensation Act, you have to jump the serious injury threshold or serious injury hurdle. You can do that in two ways, either by proving a 30% impairment or proving that you have a serious injury, that is, consequences of your injury which are more than significant or marked, or which are considered at least very considerable. If you're injured in the jurisdiction of the Wrongs Act, that is generally a public liability or medical law type claimant, you must prove that you have a significant injury. And that is defined as more than a 5% physical impairment or more than a 10% psychiatric impairment, which depend, and both of the assessments, 30% or 5% or 10%, depend on assessments under the American Medical Association guides and the Victorian Psychiatric GPIC guidelines. Now, in looking at those gateway provisions, I want to focus on the way that pain is used to elevate certain people into different categories under the guides. And in particular, what I want to do is use assessment of spinal injury and spinal and reports of pain associated with spine injury to demonstrate how pain is used or in some cases works against certain injured plaintiffs. Now, under the AMA guides, firstly, pain does not attract its own impairment percentages under Chapter 15 of the AMA guides, 4th edition. That is because when the guides were first introduced as the 4th edition in 1997, use of Chapter 15 and the pain guidelines there was excised from the guides. The reason it was excised was that the government thought that pain was sufficiently dealt with in each individual chapter through which, by which an individual person was assessed. So, for example, if you came in and reported a back injury, the doctor doing the assessment would look through the guides and see if you're in pain, see if you met certain range of motion tests, and therefore be able to afford you a percentage impairment. But when you have a look at the guides themselves, and in particular Chapter 3 in relation to the back, you can see that the guides are very sceptical about whether any reports of pain should be believed or should be used to assess your injury. Now, when you have a look, for example, at spinal impairment, impairments are given according to which category you fit into. They can be category 1, 0%, category 2, 5%, or category 3, 10%. Category 2 and 3 are the critical ones if you're a person injured in Wrongs Act circumstances, because in the Wrongs Act you must get more than 5%, which means that you must get into category 3 in order to satisfy the threshold. It's not enough for you to be in category 2 because you will fall under the threshold and not be able to bring a claim for general damages. The guides say that in order to be classified into category 2, you must report pain. Report pain. Okay, so let's take an example of someone who comes in and says, look, I've injured my back and I'm getting pain into my leg. That's often known as radicular pain. That is pain that starts in the back with the nerve root and radiates down into the leg, or it might go up and out into the arms. But if that's all the person says, I'm in pain and it extends into my leg, they will be trapped in category 2 and get only a 5% impairment. Why? Because in order to move to category 3, not only must they say I'm in pain, but the doctor must be able to test them for a series of physical indications that their pain can be verified. And that verification occurs by means of doctors asking and testing for things such as muscle guarding. That is, that the person doesn't want to use that particular part of their body. The doctor will also test for things such as loss of tendon reflexes or wasting in the particular extremity. So if the person has those things, they can then move from category 2 to category 3. But that means without those things, you'll be trapped on category 2, as I've said, and if you're a Wrongs Act claimant, that's the end of your general damages claim, because the test requires you to be more than 5%. And the guides don't work by saying, well, you can be 7.5. They move you up from category 2 to category 3. So the scepticism about how to deal with pain by the guides has led really to a system where people are, without more than just the report of pain, severely disadvantaged if you're a Wrongs Act claimant. Because the Wrongs Act claimant can only pass the gateway by getting over their 5% hurdle. If you're someone injured in under one of the statutory schemes and you fall underneath your 30% threshold, you can have recourse to the narrative test. And that is, you can come to court and say, well, look, I'm under the threshold for 30%, but the pain and suffering consequences of my injury are so considerable that I have a serious injury. And that has really been an area which plaintiffs have been pushing over the last few years. And you find expression of their efforts in two particular cases, and I'm sure people are well aware of Hayden Engineering and McKinnon, and also Sutton and Laminex Group. I'm sure some people in this room have been involved in those cases, so if I get any of the factual matters wrong, please stick your hand up and let me know. But in Hayden Engineering in McKinnon, what you had was a situation where there was a 60-year-old rigger who was descending from a work platform, and he put his foot into a hole and broke his left ankle. Once again, that's not his ankle, but it was the closest representation I could get to what he had done to his ankle, which was pins and plates inserted into it. Now, after that, he went back to work, and he worked on. He didn't quite do exactly the same job because he had some problems with going up and down ladders and climbing over uneven ground. But he went back to work. Then he and about 90% of the workforce got laid off. He went on to get another job working as a handyman at a horse farm. And he said, look, I'm in pain pretty much all the time. I take Panadol, I take Panadine. After a couple of hours, I've got to have a break, put my leg up. And I started about 6:30, but by about 1:30, 2:30, my leg's just terrible and I can't go on. At home, he struggled to get up and down ladders and do things with his leg that he would otherwise do, like mow the lawn in long bursts. And so when he came to court, in the county court, the judge said, well, I do think that he has a serious injury. It was taken on appeal, and the Court of Appeal said, in our judgment, yes, we too think it's a serious injury because of all the reports of pain and suffering that he has. But it seems undoubted to me that the court probably put a lot of weight on the fact that he could hold up an x-ray, Mr. McKinnon, and say, well, look, this is what happened to my ankle. No one can dispute that. This is what happened to it. It's still got the pins and plates in it. And you can see why I say to you, I'm in pain. And that's traditionally what people have thought about serious injury. If you've got something organically to show on a scan or to have a doctor come along and opine about, then you're well on your way to proving serious injury. Then came the case of Sutton and Laminex, and in Sutton, you had a man who I think was just about 50 years of age, and his job was to drive forklifts and attach them to a line of trolleys and then pull those trolleys along. When he backed his forklift up to the trolleys, though, he was a bit short. So he got out of the forklift and he reached across with his right hand and he tried to pull the dead weight of these trolleys over to attach to the back of the forklift. But as he was reaching over and pulling them, he said he felt a burning sensation into his neck and into his face. He felt tingling and a hot flush sensation down into his right hand. And he felt sore all over the top of his shoulder. When he went to his doctor, he said, I've got all these problems. And his doctor said, right, I think you've done something to your disc. I think you've probably torn a muscle here and you've probably got some nerve damage. So he thought three things. He went off and had extensive investigation about those things. Firstly, all the scans came back showing the neck injury was degenerative change, essentially. There were disc bulges, very small, but with no nerve root involvement. In terms of the soft tissue injury, it was found that there was no great tear. There was no obvious pulling apart of the fibres. At most, there was what the doctors called mild tendinopathy. That was all. And in terms of the nerve conduction tests, the EMG tests, they were all clear, excluding any nerve injury. But still the plaintiff said, I've got the pain and it's into my neck and into my face and I can feel the tingling in my hands and the numbness and it bothers me all the time. I can't sleep properly, I take tablets all the time, can't do my old job and I've changed my job. And his wife gave evidence too and she said, well, he can't sleep as well as he used to and he's always waking up and he doesn't like rolling onto his right side. So when Sutton came before the Court of Appeal, the plaintiff was really confined to the fact that he could report the pain only, and he couldn't point to any particular piece of medical evidence that says That's the cause of the pain. All he could do is say, believe me, I'm in pain. And the Court of Appeal said essentially, yes, we do believe that you're in pain, and we believe that the consequences for you are at least very considerable. And on that basis, they granted him the serious injury certificate and leave to go before a jury and say, compensate me for my pain and suffering. But you really have to wonder, and I'm sure that some people know the answer to this, I really wonder whether if Mr. Sutton had been injured under the Wrongs Act, or in circumstances under the Wrongs Act, whether he would have even got to 5%. Because if you go back to what I was saying about the DRE categories, he could complain of pain, but he couldn't show a loss of reflex, he couldn't show an EMG study to say he'd got some nerve problems, and he didn't have any verifiable signs of his pain. There was reported to be some minor muscle wasting, but that's only one criteria required to move you from DRE 2 to DRE 3. So I really wonder if Mr. Sutton would have made it over the threshold and got before a court to claim damages if he was a Wrongs Act claimant only. And it does, to my mind, seem to be a really anomalous situation where, depending on where you are injured, determines whether or not you get to make a claim for your pain and suffering. Yes, certainly, Mr. Shafer.
Just very quickly, that effectively means that with the development of the narrative test through the interpretation through the courts, that it's often much easier to achieve serious injury level of impairment than it is to achieve significant injury. That's effectively what you're saying, isn't it?
Yes.
Which can't, I mean, that must skew the whole concept, surely.
I think on one view the government's got a very clear view about it. They've used very different terminology and they've just got a different view that it ought to be easier in certain circumstances than in other circumstances, and those are if you're injured in a Wrongs Act setting, it ought to be harder
for you. So you're penalising the circumstances in which the plaintiff came to be injured, and he gets penalised if it's a medical case as distinct from an industrial case.
Well, it does lead to different results. I'm sure there's a political interpretation of that, but it does lead to different results, I think. But Mr. Kurt might have a view about that.
I don't have a dog in that fight. Thank you very much, Arushan. We've got time for some questions, so... If anybody would like to ask a question, now's your opportunity. And please identify the speaker that you wish to question.
Well, I'll ask another question, if I may. Is there any correlation between, and I'll ask both speakers, is there any correlation between the significance of a physical injury and the believability about the pain that that patient continues to complain about? What I'm saying is that if you have a severe physical injury and a patient complains of ongoing pain, is that easier to accept than if the injury is not as severe?
I think prima facie the answer is yes. But if the second part of my third proposition is correct, and Dave's already challenged me on that one, so I'm very nervous about my third proposition, I have to say. It's certainly the case that you can have a severe psychological stroke, psychiatric reaction to a relatively insignificant event. I think that's very well established by the medical science, even though that does fly in the face to a certain extent of what common sense would be. And so I think you just have to examine each of the spaces. One of the things I recall about Professor Davis's testimony is he went to some lengths on this area where after 30 years as a specialist and everything, he said he doesn't think he knows very much about this area and why some patients go on to get a very painful ongoing pain disorder of some type even after an insignificant injury, and other people will go through a great deal and just recover. And he, to his credit, was telling us he doesn't understand it. So, and that's I guess my third proposition, that you have to really look at that, take testimony from people like that that are actually have no dog in the game, have no bias, and just get the best medical evidence, and that should be persuasive rather than what you might think just from reading the newspapers or the magazines would be the case.
Can I just say, I think the answer is yes, Michael, very easily. And you just have to have a look at the photo of that X-ray of the ankle that isn't Mr. McKinnon's. All of us would see that and say that must have been terribly painful. But when people suffer emotional reaction, we bear other people's emotional reaction much easier than they do. And that's just human nature. That's why when you're a plaintiff, you produce photos of the injury when it's acute, because people understand it much better. And you can't show a photograph of emotional pain. So I think it's always difficult. And we always say that juries treat psychiatric injuries with some apprehension. Sometimes if the plaintiff's persuasive, they do very well. But if the plaintiff is an unusual person, they can be punished for that, and often unfairly. So it's much easier if you've got a plaintiff who is credible, even mainstream, if I could say that, where you've got unusual plaintiffs, people think there might be something funny going in the background here, and they're apprehensive about accepting their veracity. That's just a part of human nature, I think. Any other questions? Okay, it's 9:15. Thank you very much for coming. I hope you feel much less pain now than you did at 7:15. Please thank our speakers again.